You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, youth sports are swinging back into action. A doctor who works with young athletes says we still need some serious precautions for COVID-19. Now, people across the country watched and waited Tuesday for the jury's ruling on former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd. One of those watching was our next guest, who says the jury's guilty ruling was right, but he says this should just be the start of efforts around police reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you watching for that verdict? What was your reaction? Do you think changes are needed when it comes to American policing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James E. Causey is a columnist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. He wrote a recent opinion piece talking about the Chauvin verdict. James, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What was your reaction, James, on Tuesday when this long-awaited verdict came down?
Actually, I was a bit surprised, but not totally surprised. I was thinking that if there was ever a case where a police officer was going to be found guilty on all counts, this had to be the case. I mean, the videotape, the 9 minutes plus on this man's neck for a counterfeit $20 bill that we don't even know if he knew it was a counterfeit bill or not. It just seems like if justice wasn't going to be found on this case, I don't think justice could ever be found on any case.
In the piece I mentioned, you talked about how this relates to what you've seen in Milwaukee. You talked to some other people in Milwaukee communities. What's on your mind when it comes to Milwaukee after that verdict now?
Well, Milwaukee still has a long ways to go, like most major urban cities. I mean, there needs to be a better relationship between the community and police officers and law enforcement in general. Law enforcement has to show respect to citizens, and citizens also have to respect officers as well. It's a mutual thing that needs to take place. We always talk about relationships between law enforcement and the community, but it only comes up when something bad happens. It never comes up when things are good. And right now, this is a time for action and a time to have those hard conversations about when a person is stopped. It's time to have conversations about the use of force in certain cases. And it's time to have real conversation about what real reform looks like.
We've seen a couple catchphrases come out a lot over the last year, James. In some protests, some people had the phrase, all cops are bad. Also, there's the idea that, hey, there's a few bad apples. We got one in this case, but in general, things are okay. You're not comfortable, if I'm reading you right, with either of those.
No, I mean, I have several friends of mine who believe that there's no such thing as a good cop. And I think they come to that conclusion because, and it's like, if we just look at the George Floyd case, there were officers there who could have done more to stop this from turning into a death scene. They didn't do anything. They stood by and watched and participated in holding Mr. Floyd down. And so even though Chauvin was the only one charged with three guilty counts, I'm saying that the other officers are just as guilty for not stepping up and just pulling Chauvin off of his neck. I mean, that didn't take much effort to say, hey, that's enough. Hey, partner, that's enough. We have a case right now. I don't know if you've seen the video where this officer started punching this lady, this handcuffed woman in the face. He punched her twice and one of his fellow officers grabbed him and stopped him. That's what we need to see. We need to see officers when their partner is going too far, stepping in and protecting this person from an officer and also preventing a large lawsuit. I mean, these lawsuits are costing taxpayers millions and millions of dollars. And I just don't understand that. That needs to change right away.
Talking to James Causey, columnist of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about his reactions to the Derek Chauvin verdict in Minneapolis and looking ahead at policing in Milwaukee and beyond. And James, you also wrote that you had a conversation with a friend who said George Floyd would be alive if he had complied with police from the start of that encounter. That's something we hear from callers from time to time as well. What do you make of that argument?
Well, what I make of that argument is I call BS on that, because we've seen cases where people have complied or they've been too scared to do exactly what officer is saying to do. You know, you have one officer scream, put your hands up, and another guy screaming, put your hands on your steering wheel, do blah, 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 blah. You know, how are we supposed to react when you have all these people screaming at you? You know, the case with the lieutenant, for instance, the guy that was in the SUV where he got pepper sprayed by the two officers. You know, the officers are screaming at him, and this guy is a lieutenant with the U.S. Army. He said, I'm scared right now. You guys are pointing guns at me. I don't know what to do. And they were like, well, get out of the car. Get out of the car. Undo your seatbelt. And he didn't want to move his hands because he knows what happens when people of color make sudden movements or appear to be reaching. That could be a life or death sentence. And it shouldn't be like that.
You drove to the George Floyd Memorial in Minneapolis. What was that experience like for you?
Man, I got to tell you, that was life changing. My wife and I, we decided to go see for ourselves what it looked like. And it was, honestly, it was somber. It was very quiet, even though there were a lot of people at the scene. People were very respectful and just walked like, it was almost like you were walking in a graveyard because you had all these names written on the street and of people who lost their lives to law enforcement officers and in those kind of cases. And then you had all these poetic sayings all around. And then you had these pictures of George Floyd, flowers and things like that. It was like, it was almost like being at a cemetery, a large 3-block-long cemetery. And I don't think I would ever forget that. Some people were crying. A lot of people took pictures, but it's something I'd never forget.
You mentioned the idea of police and communities getting along better, police treating community members with respect and community members treating police with respect. But a lot of times, I don't know, it seems like we fall into an us versus them mentality on a lot of issues, much less police community relationships. Do you have thoughts on ways, and I think I've talked to you about this in the past, James, do you have thoughts on ways to start building that relationship that doesn't start with that it's us against you mindset?
Well, I think it gets back to community policing. It gets back to officers being in communities, talking with people and really getting to know who these people are. You know, one of the biggest problems that we have in our city is that nearly half of the officers who live in Milwaukee or who work for the Milwaukee Police Department don't live in the city. So when you don't live in the city, you don't shop in the city, your kids don't go to school in the city, you live in the burbs or somewhere else, then how can you really have a true connection to the city? I know some officers will argue, yeah, I could do that, and it doesn't bother me. But I argue that if you're connected to the city and it's a city job, it's Milwaukee Police Department, that to me, that job belongs to the people of Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee. So you should live in the city that you serve. So when they changed that rule, when the Walker administration and they pushed to change that rule, I think it really hurt relationships between police officers and the community a lot more than a lot of people would even know.
A lot of talk about police reform now, James, at the federal level, the state level, local governments. It can mean a lot of different things. What would be at the top of your list for priorities?
One thing, I think officers' pensions should be the first thing that they should lose. I don't think you should be allowed to kill someone and still collect your pension. I don't think taxpayers should be responsible for bad officers doing what they do. You know, it's like I say, it costs millions and millions of dollars to taxpayers when an officer commits a bad act and they're just wrong. And to me, why should the citizens, a lot of them are people of color, be punished for that? I don't want to pay for an officer's bad decision. An officer should have to pay for their own bad decision. And I think another thing that needs to happen when we talk about defunding the police, I think a lot of people get upset about that. What that really means is taking some of that money, because some of these police budgets are up to 60% of the city's budget. Think about that. You're taking 60% of the city's budget and the crime is still spiking. Homicides are still spiking. And then just to maintain what you have, not to improve, but just to maintain, you still need an increase to the police budget. That makes absolutely no sense. Why would you give money to someone and say, hey, I want you to wash my car, and you give them $1 to wash your car, but they half wash your car. And then they come back to you later and say, okay, I need more money to really clean the rims this time. And then you say, wait, I gave you the full amount to wash my car. But that's what the police department keeps doing. They keep asking for more money and they keep getting it, and things are not getting better. So we got to try a different way.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thank you.
That's James Causey with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, columnist there with us today to talk about his latest opinion piece. The jury got the Chauvin verdict right this time is the headline, but this should be the only beginning of police reform. Up next, we'll continue the conversation about policing after the Chauvin verdict. A former federal prosecutor joins the show to talk about a federal investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department and the revival of some kinds of federal oversight of local police departments. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more federal oversight, see federal officials be more aggressive looking into local police departments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about police reform following the conviction of Derek Chauvin. The U.S. Department of Justice announced an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department's practices this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions about what the federal government does when it comes to oversight over local police departments. If you'd like to see more of that, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Cami Chavis is Vice Provost, Professor of Law, and Director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University. She's also a former federal prosecutor. Cami, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to listen to a little audio of Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing this week an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department.
The investigation I am announcing today will assess whether the Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of using excessive force, including during protests.
Cami, can you tell us about this kind of pattern or practice investigation from the federal government? What goes into something like that?
Yes, well, the authority for these types of investigations began in 1994. We had just actually come off of the horrific beating of Rodney King, and there was an idea that it's not just one bad apple or two bad apples, but that police misconduct, the root of it, can be systemic, can be organizational. And so how do you address organizational police misconduct? The federal government has this authority now to go in and investigate what's happening in Minneapolis.
And one particular item that's been reported on here looks into the original statement from the department, the police department of Minneapolis, after Floyd's death, which omitted a lot of detail and was inaccurate. How significant would it be if the investigation reveals that that's a pattern, misrepresenting the events that happened in these kind of incidents?
Yes. So it's very important. That's exactly what this investigation will look at. We'll look at patterns. It's not one single incident. As horrific as the events surrounding Mr. Floyd's death are, that alone wouldn't necessarily be sufficient to connote a pattern. But yes, if there were multiple instances of that, mostly what these investigations are focused on would be the uses of force. Training, is there a lack of training? Or do officers in that department receive proper training? There'll be a comprehensive review of internal police policies, procedures, as well as how the department handles their complaints. Some of the previous investigations have revolved around racial profiling, so that may or may not be an issue here. So there are a lot of different things that that the investigation may cover, and it's really promising to see these federal investigations begin again.
Another phrase that's come up now related to the federal government looking at local police departments is the consent decree. We heard about them a lot more before the Trump administration. They put them on the back burner or mostly stopped them. We've had consent decrees, for example, in Milwaukee, I believe. What is a consent decree, Cami, and how does it work?
Yes. So a consent decree is a judicially enforceable agreement or set of recommendations. And so how these investigations work, let's say, for example, that a pattern or practice of unlawful behavior was found in any local police department. The DOJ, the executives from the city, executives from the police department, and community members, and hopefully rank and file police officers through the unions, hopefully everyone would think about what's best in terms of reform. And there's a judicially enforceable consent decree that would contain different reforms. It may be things like keeping, and just to give you some examples from other consent decrees, it may be that you need to keep track of the race in terms of racial profiling. It may mean that you have to revamp your use of force policies. It may mean that you need to identify problem officers. And I think that that could be an issue in Minneapolis, because we know that, for example, Derek Chauvin had several, many complaints against him. And if there's a pattern of multiple officers with multiple complaints and no discipline or retraining or anything like that, that could be a significant issue. That would be something that you would want to remedy. Let's find those officers and deal with them in some way. So there's a variety of things that, and again, an investigation will be important to think about any recommendations specific to Minneapolis that would be included in a consent decree.
Talking to Cami Chavis from Wake Forest University, former federal prosecutor, looking at federal interventions in local police departments, things like pattern and practice reviews happening soon in Minneapolis, and consent decrees, which have happened in a number of cities, the Biden administration reopening the door to those. All right, Cami, in principle, I think I get how these things work. In practice, is it really that easy for some federal officials to come in and actually make meaningful changes in the culture and practices of a local police department?
So, you know, they can be. I think that the having the investigation, having this legislation, the authority is important, because if Minneapolis, for example, we know what happened in Minneapolis, and now if Minneapolis is subject to this pattern or practice investigation, the hope would be that other local police departments around the nation, and we know there are 18,000 local police departments, but that they might say, okay, well, I don't want the federal government to come here, so let me go ahead and let's fix our practices. But these consent decrees, if you look at the entire body, and there have been dozens of these since 1994, if you were to look at them, they really give you a good idea about principles that promote police integrity and promote accountability. And so they are a wealth of information. There have been a few studies. I think the hardest part about, and it's a cautionary tale here, is that we're expecting immediate reform. And I think one critique of this authority is the way that this can be a lengthy investigation, and then depending on what the reforms are, there could be some time to make sure that those are fully implemented.
With just about any issue we could name, Cami, there's a debate over how much the federal government should be involved versus state or local governments. When it comes to overseeing local police departments, what do you see as the value of having at least some federal role in the kind of practices we're talking about?
Yes, and I think it's really interesting. You mentioned this earlier, that the Trump administration had stepped back from this enforcement, and really actually Jeff Sessions and Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Attorney General former Attorney General Jeff Sessions and William Barr were openly hostile, really, to this type of involvement. And it is a big deal when you have the federal government that comes along to work with a local government. And it's how it's perceived. Are they working with the local entities? My understanding is that in Minneapolis, the city council welcomed this investigation because of the benefits that that might come from it. But yes, I think that there are a number of different things. The city may not have the resources to do this type of investigation and to make the reforms on their own, to know what's required. So it can be helpful in that way, but it's really going to require the cooperation of the local authorities there. And it should also be done in conjunction with the community and with the rank and file police officers. And my understanding is that the Justice Department understands that and that they have already spoken to community groups. And so that should not be an issue here.
So we've got this pattern and practice review coming to Minneapolis. Do you expect, now that consent decrees are back under the table with current Attorney General Merrick Garland, do you expect to see more of these, maybe even lots of these in the next couple of few years?
Well, the problem with, and this is, again, one critique of this federal authority, is that Attorney General Garland is but one one man, one Justice Department. And as I said, there are 18,000 local police departments, many of which could use some assistance. So the Justice Department, even though the federal government, it does have limited resources. So we will see, I'm sure that we will see more investigations than we saw with the Trump administration. But to say that we will see, you know, we're not going to see hundreds. We're not going to see that. Just there's not the resources to do that. That's why it's important. I do know that some states are looking at enacting analogous legislation at the state level. And so then that way, again, you could have not just the federal attorney general, but you could have state attorney generals who are performing some of the same investigations and making recommendations at a state level.
We'll leave it there. Cammy, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Cammy Chavis, former federal prosecutor, currently the director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University. She was with us today to talk about the Biden administration's revival of consent decrees and what to expect in a federal investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department. Coming up, youth sports are taking place with pandemic precautions. A guest shares advice on COVID safety on the field. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you find yourself in a park or natural area this weekend, remember three magic words: leave no trace. We'll talk about what that means and how you can help preserve those spaces for the future coming up. Now, parents of student athletes in Michigan schools are challenging the state's authority to require weekly testing for kids who participate in sports. Meanwhile, COVID-19 cases have risen in places where youth sports are in full swing. Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler is a doctor of podiatric medicine specializing in sports medicine and a professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University in Detroit. She recently wrote a piece for The Conversation titled "Why Student Athletes Need a New Playbook to Stay Safe in the COVID-19 Era." Dr. Hugh Butler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, you were thinking about this with some controversy in Michigan, the Let Them Play movement and state regulations. What's going on there?
So, you know, now we are the epicenter of cases of coronavirus, and they linked it to youth sports. And so youth sports were allowed to play in February 8th. And what happened was, is there, unlike pro sports and collegiate sports, there wasn't a lot of like testing, or there wasn't very, very firm guidelines. And so, you know, coronavirus like really spread, I think, through the youth sports. And so then they came down and said, you know, we need to test the athletes once a week. And they test the pro athletes and the college athletes like every day. So this wasn't a big ask, but the parents that then actually they filed a lawsuit, like, no, you know, this is against our right, and the State Department doesn't have any authority to do that. But the question is, if you don't see it, you can never detect it. And I think that that was part of the problem. So
before we talk a little more about safety protocols and such, part of you, I know, sympathizes with the parents and athletes. You're a fan of youth sports. Ideally, you'd like us to get to a place where kids can play, right?
Absolutely. You know, so I'm a runner and a big sports fan. So, you know, we know the benefits, the mental health and all the physical benefits that sports participation like gives us and the kids. And so, you know, it pulls at our hearts because the kids want to play. And we as adults, you know, we want to say, give in to them. But we're the adults and we have to actually, you know, come down and say it's not that safe.
And I know people look at the numbers and say, okay, the COVID-19 is way more serious for people who are older, but that doesn't mean it's completely safe for kids. Could you talk about the risks for kids? And we're talking mainly, you know, the junior high, high school student age population here. Can you talk about the risks that are still out there, even though they're not the main demographic hit by COVID-19?
Well, what's really interesting and the game changer is these variants that are hitting Michigan in particular. And we have all three variants. We have the UK, the South African, and the Brazilian variants. And so they're hitting the younger population harder. So the hospitalization rate of COVID, not even like the inflammatory scenario afterwards, of COVID has risen by like 300%. So these new variants are more contagious, and they seem to affect children much more than they did before. So that's become the problem. So it's not that the kids actually will spread it to the adults and we worry about the adults. The kids are actually having problems now, too. And so that's the really big, big worry that we're having.
We're talking to Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler from Wayne State University in Detroit, looking at a piece she wrote for The Conversation on youth sports and COVID safety. Dr. Hugh Butler, as kids do go and play, what kind of precautions? Let's start with an outdoor sport, now that it's happily warming up and kids are doing things outdoors. What kind of precautions would you like to see teams take for those outdoor sports?
So even if you're outdoor or an indoor sport, I still think that testing is important. So, you know, the once a week mandate is not a big ask. But again, too, the problem is we don't see it. So even if you're playing an outdoor sport, even if you're playing softball and you're in close contact with somebody, you know, just by talking to the other player, you can actually transmit this virus. So the precautions, it obviously when you're outside, the virus can spread in the air a lot faster. It's not all concentrated. So again, too, that, you know, the same thing that everybody's saying, you know, keeping the distance, 6 feet is not magical, but again, too, that's the distance where droplets can actually spread. And then again, if you can wear a mask, you know, that helps prevent the transmission as well. So I think testing, still staying apart and wearing the mask, if you can, will help prevent the transmission of COVID outdoors. But the risk is less on the outside than it is on the inside.
Yeah, I want to go inside now with the basketballs and hockey and sports that take place indoors. What kind of extra concerns do you have there?
So with the indoor sports, you know, there isn't a lot of ventilation. So again, too, the air can get more concentrated with the virus. And so that's the bigger problem of the transmission. So again, too, you know, making sure the masks fit well, the testing becomes even more important. So not even just like once a week, if you're really going to have some contact, I think it probably should be, you know, the college level, it's 5 days a week. I think that's really the big safety key. And, you know, now they're saying about the disinfection rates, it doesn't transmit as much on surfaces rather than by breathing. But, you know, what I do notice in the indoor sports, and, you know, we just had the basketball tournament, and if you look at any of the pictures, the masks are like around their chins. I mean, and that's the biggest thing. It's like, well, we wear our mask, but you need to wear the mask over the mouth and the nose to prevent the virus from spreading. And I think that's kind of like one of the biggest misinterpretations of the rules that occurs and why this is spreading, particularly inside.
What are you watching for when it comes to vaccination, and what kind of things do you see that opening up as kids get vaccinated, in their youth sports players get vaccinated?
So So again, too, I know that in Michigan it's above 16. I would imagine in Wisconsin it's you can get vaccinated if you're above 16. So again, too, but what the vaccination will protect you, give you some immunity against the virus. But what happens is once you get it, particularly like with the Pfizer and the Moderna, it takes 6 weeks from the time you get your first shot to the time where you actually have enough immunity to fight it. So again, too, I know in Michigan, the governor was like, well, we need to like, you know, up the vaccine. But, you know, we're a little bit too late. You in Wisconsin, your cases are fairly low. Your positivity rate's 3%. So you can really try to vaccinate as many people as possible to try to get back to normal. What's really nice is this really contagious variant from the UK seems to be affected by the vaccines. Is quite effective against that. So the more that you can vaccinate now where the cases are low, the more you're going to prevent spread. And the sooner that we can actually play sports and go to concerts and events without the risks that we had of another surge.
And you make the case that, you know, this is kind of an us versus them with, shutting down sports or requiring testing versus people who want it as open as possible. You're hoping that, no, we can all be on the same team with us versus COVID-19. Can you share your hopes for people to work together on the same side?
Yeah, you know, I think we're battling each other. And so, again, to the team approach of like team coronavirus, we are on the same team. So my hope with this piece was to get people to understand why we need to wear the mask, why we need to test so that we can identify the infected people, pull them out so that sports can become safe. And so if we all play on the safety team, we should be able to suppress the virus. And I think if people understand that, it makes the decision a lot easier, because what happens now is all the kids here and the parents and the coaches is no, you can't do this, you can't do that, you have to wear masks. And so you hear rules and they're like binary rules. But my hope was if we understand why we're doing it, we're all going to like play on this with the same mentality together to fight this. Because once we can suppress it down to a level where we can like put out little fires, we're all going to be fine. But if we keep, like with this lawsuit, if we keep fighting against each other, we're not going to win against the virus. So that was my hope, that if we put it in this team effort, because also too, you know, everyone talks about, oh, we have virus fatigue. But if you look at the good teams, they don't get tired. You know, you keep pushing. You know, those good teams like keep doing the right thing and they work hard and they eventually win. So I was hoping to get that across.
Dr. Hugh Butler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and stay safe out there.
That's Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler, professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University. She talked to us about her piece for The Conversation titled Why Student Athletes Need a New Playbook to Stay Safe in the COVID-19 Era. Coming up, we'll find out how to enjoy Wisconsin's parks and natural areas without spoiling them for others or harming the environment. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup, from President Biden's plans on climate change to the rise and fall of a sports super league. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, with winter pretty much in the rearview mirror, you might be tempted to visit a park or natural area in the state. Lots of people had that idea last year, driven in part by the pandemic. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources said 20.6 million people headed to state park system properties, up 3 million from the previous year. But with all those visitors, many of them new, come some opportunities for problems. Some are a little small, like not following proper trail etiquette, or seemingly small. Others more serious, like leaving trash behind. So the DNR is offering three words of encouragement to make natural areas enjoyable for everyone. Leave no trace. Missy Van Landit is the Recreation Partnership Section Chief with the Wisconsin State Parks System. Missy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Are you expecting another big year for state park attendance?
You know, we are. We're preparing for at least what we saw last year. And right now we're actually trending even more than that. The first few months of 2021 have shown about a 25% increase over 2019. So even bigger than last year, but we're getting prepared.
And last year we had some COVID restrictions related to the parks. Any COVID-related policies that people need to know about this year?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is pretty similar to last year. Most of our facilities are still closed, with the exception of restrooms, especially in the campgrounds. But all of our restrooms will be open for this year. Our nature centers, office buildings, things like that are still closed. Couple good things, though. We are opening up our standalone concession facilities to 50% occupancy. So our concessions will virtually be back to normal. We are also opening up our towers and playgrounds as of April 30th. And we're increasing our capacity for open air shelters, outdoor group camps, and amphitheaters from 50 to 100. So we're continuing on the spectrum, and you know, we're always evaluating our operations and continuing to open things up as we can safely do so.
And before we get into the rules of the road, could you make the case for people getting out into nature, whether it's the state park or a local space in their community?
You know, everybody seems to be loving the outdoors lately, which is great for us. And, you know, it really can fulfill that mental, social, you know, physical wellness aspects and even the emotional wellness piece. You know, getting outside can be healing for so many. And we're just glad that there's so much public land in Wisconsin for people to enjoy.
Now, you're glad, as you say, people are checking out state parks. But, you know, a lot of people, 20 million visits, it could take a toll on landscape, ecosystems, fellow visitors. Can you talk about the sort of things that you worry about if parks are overused and not used, I guess, with wise stewardship?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, especially some of the things that we saw last year, which get to some of those, you know, leave no trace principles. But, you know, a big one is people staying where there are designated areas. So that means parking in designated parking areas and camping in designated camping areas and staying on the trails. That is a really big thing that we see right now, especially with spring and the mud. So many people are out and about and they maybe don't want to get their shoes dirty, so they go around the mud. And actually that causes more damage, not only to habitat and plants, but it can also widen the trail. It can make it unstable and essentially could cause more repair and need, you know, more repair and damages down the road. So a big thing is just going where you're allowed to go and not going where you're not allowed to go.
And yeah, I think sometimes people might be tempted to think, oh, if just I do it, just one person does it, it goes off the trail, it's not a big deal. But it can be a little deal and it can really add up fast, I imagine.
Exactly. Because then, you know, other folks start to see, well, they did it, it must be okay, so I can do it. And we certainly saw that last year. And that's a lot of the reason why we ended up using different tools to manage our capacity, including capacity closures, which we're still expecting to use throughout, you know, periodically throughout the year this year, primarily in an effort not only for people to have the opportunity to safely social distance, but also realizing that, especially in the summer, those popular areas like beaches and trails, people are more drawn to those. And so we've reduced our capacity again to give people more of an opportunity to spread out on the landscape.
Talking to Missy Van Landit with the Wisconsin State Park System, looking at the joys of using our state parks and how to use them in ways that make them great places for years to come. Tell us a little, Missy, about the leave no trace concept.
Yeah, you know, there's seven general principles that people follow, you know, and I think they all apply to all of us, which is nice. And if you haven't heard of Leave No Trace, you maybe the hashtag Recreate Responsibly is going around now, or Responsible Recreation. And it's basically the same thing. And, you know, the first one is really just planning ahead. Know where you're going, know what you're doing. Be prepared for your visit. And, you know, that even goes for this time of year as we start to think about tick awareness and Lyme disease awareness. So just planning for your visit. The other one is what we just talked about, you know, going where you're supposed to go and not going where you're not supposed to go. A big one that we actually had a huge problem with last year was disposing of waste. So packing it in and packing it out. And, you know, utilizing, and this, it should go without saying, but utilizing the facilities that are available to you as humans. So making sure that you're utilizing those vault toilets and the toilet facilities when you need to, rather than other places. So that was actually a really big problem last year. And so many people not packing in and packing out like their granola bar wrappers and water bottles and things like that. So, you know, disposing of your waste properly. And leaving what you find where you find it, moving sticks and branches, you know, building structures, moving rocks, things like that is actually can be damaging to the environment and can damage valuable habitats. So leaving what you find where you find it is huge. And now with, you know, with it being fire season, there's a lot of burn bans everywhere. So minimizing the impacts of your campfire and being aware of burn bans in your area, and only having fires where it's permitted. We've had hundreds of wildfires across the state already this year. So, you know, that is really heightened awareness, especially in the dry spring that we've had.
Missy, one topic that came up for me and my wife actually just last weekend had to do with trail etiquette. Who has the right of way when you're going? I was at Devil's Lake. We left the right of way to the lake flies by the lake, went over to the Ice Age Trail. And, you know, who gives way to the other one? This being Wisconsin, the biggest risk is everybody's going to stand there and wait for the other person to go, and you'll be there all day. What is the right way to handle that?
You know, most of the time what you should do is you know, be courteous, yield to others. If you're going on the downhill side of the trail, you should be the one to yield to the people coming up. So definitely if you're, which I think I always want to do it the opposite way because I'm looking for a rest, right? So you're just like, oh, I want to wait. And, you know, that's fine. I'll pull over to the side here and let people come down. But it's actually the other way around. So if you're heading down, you yield to the people coming up. And again, that applies whether there's mud or otherwise. I think I've seen actually throughout the pandemic, a lot of people are wearing buffs or bringing their masks in their pockets. And that's a really good thing to make note of, is that if you're out on a trail and you can't distance, you can pop your buff up or your mask and go around people. And I think most people on trails have been very considerate of that as well.
Let's talk about keeping the right of way for wildlife. People want to treat animals well, and they might think that includes feeding them. I understand. No, not the best call there.
Not the best call there. And, you know, this is spring is the time for baby animals as well. And I think, you know, with our big hearts out there, people really want to rescue wildlife. So, you know, the DNR actually has the Leave Wildlife Wild campaign. And so leaving those animals alone, I think many people don't realize that the mothers or parents of those babies are out hunting or have distanced themselves from their babies to not attract predators. So just let wildlife be wild and don't feed it. Don't try to capture it. Don't take it anywhere. If you do find one that's injured, you can call our conservation wardens or other rescue centers, but otherwise leave wildlife wild.
And Missy, something I've enjoyed since last year now is finding either places I didn't know about or, you know, out of the way places that are off the beaten path, but still on a real path in the more famous state parks. Are there good ways to find those hidden gems that maybe not everybody knows about?
You know, absolutely. It's we have our Out We Go initiative, which is our initiative to have health and wellness in the outdoors. And if you go to the DNR webpage, dnr.wi.gov, and search Out We Go, which is OUTWIGO, we actually have coming up here in the next couple of weeks, you'll see a hidden gems graphic on there where you can find a hidden gem at every property. We're also launching in the next couple of weeks a search by activity function on that page. So you can search by whether you want to off-road bike, camp, hike, kayak, go to a beach, and you'll be able to search by activity. So check those things out. But our Out We Go page, we change seasonally and put up relevant information for helping you find those hidden gems.
One of my favorite things is finding hiking trails that are loops instead of, you know, going there and back or having to move a car or something like that. Looped trails or looped trails. Are there any good ways to find those awesome loops, Missy?
You know, each property has its own webpage on within the DNR webpage, so you can certainly find those. With the exception of our linear rail trails, which is 1,700 miles of kind of those one-way trails and the Ice Age Trail, most of our trails at properties are actually loop trails, and they encompass, you know, a big loop on the property where you can start and not have to retrace your steps. So all of that detailed trail information is on each of those property pages.
Well, Missy, I think we'll leave it there. I hope you can come back and share some hidden gems with us when those new resources are out, and enjoy the weekend.
You too. Thank you so much.
Missy Van Landit is the Recreation Partnerships Section Chief with the Wisconsin State Parks System. We talked to her today about how to enjoy Wisconsin State Parks while minimizing the human impact on a natural place. You can let us know your favorite hidden gems at Wisconsin State Parks or other local parks in your area. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7, it's the State Capitol Report with a look at efforts here in Wisconsin aimed at bringing down the cost of prescription medications. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the Academy Awards are coming up this weekend. We'll talk to Reggie the Real Critic about his favorites and his picks to take home the gold. And we want to hear from you. You can join in the ongoing conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page that started yesterday. A lot of comments up there about your favorite movie music, whether you're talking about scores or soundtracks. Love to hear from some more of you. Is there a movie that you like to listen to, that you have on some form of audio format that you'd like to listen to even without the movie? Email ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or again, tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let us know what you want to see win the Oscars while you're at it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.